Hello and welcome to episode 22 of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. This time you find me in discussion with Jill Aitken, who's registrar at the University of Oxford. Jill talks through her career from private sector legal firm to civil service lawyer in the Department of Health, also leading various professional teams, and now her first couple of years at Oxford, where she has responsibility for a wide range of professional services departments, as well as, inevitably, the university's COVID response. We explore Jill's experience of making the transition from civil servant to registrar, an increasingly common step in the sector these days, and the transferability of approaches and experience, including successfully managing complexity, influence and relationships. Discussing the COVID response at Oxford, we learn about how the university's 39 colleges added an extra layer of real complexity, but actually worked together extremely well, with everyone pulling in the same direction and making great contributions to the collective effort, as well as managing local support for students very capably. Jill comments too on the successes of the university's own test and tracing system, where it is able to get results quickly and manage local tracing effectively to control clusters and minimise the spread. Oxford's also made a significant COVID research contribution and is, at the time of our recording, hoping for a positive announcement on its vaccine development. We talk about some other issues too, including the really positive relationships with the city and county councils, the supportive response from local communities, the new approach to professional services working patterns, and that we all anticipate will happen post-pandemic, but also the longer-term prognosis for the UK higher education sector. It's a great conversation, and I really do hope you enjoy it.
Right, well, welcome everyone to the latest edition of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. And this time it's my enormous pleasure to introduce Jill Aitken, who is registrar at the University of Oxford. Well, welcome, Jill. It's great to be talking to you. And I wonder if we could kick off by you telling us, you know, about your career, really. How did you end up at Oxford? But also, what do you actually do as registrar at Oxford?
Goodness, that's a long story. So I've been at Oxford for 2 years. It's my first university job and first time in the sector. And I was for 20 odd, in fact, probably longer, 30 years, I think, a career civil servant. I'm a lawyer by training. I started off in the city as a pharmaceutical lawyer. I kept suing the Department of Health, judicially reviewing them. And there came a point when I thought it would be so much more fun to design the law and be in the buzz of politics. So I moved across to the Government Legal Service. And that this is an honoured route, I have to say, to registrar roles in universities, because I'm not alone in coming from that stable. My life as a government lawyer, in fact, grew very quickly, so that by the time I was at board level in various large ministries, I was also running a variety of corporate services. So I picked up some skills to run stuff, operational skills, and that just made me the combination of being a lawyer but also knowing how to run HR and finance and IT and all of those things meant that when the knock came to the door that there was a job going in Oxford and would I like to apply, I was a reasonably good fit. And it fitted in with my life. That moving physically to Oxford, it has been delightful. So what do I do now that I'm here? This is my third year. I spent the first year working out what the job was. I think I more or less know now. So I do run the professional services for the university. They're devolved across all of four academic divisions, about 70 departments, all depending, as in time-honoured fashion, depending on how you count. I lead those professional services. More recently, so since March, of course, that has continued to be my day job, I have been coordinating the planning on COVID. And I think probably I would say that I'm a COVID administrator in the most recent incarnation of my job.
And I mean, that is, it's a really interesting backstory. I mean, you did manage some professional services when you were in the civil service, I think you said. But did that in any way, I mean, did it really prepare you for what life in the Oxford administration was like? Was it a did it feel like a seamless transition?
It certainly wasn't seamless, and it did take that year to work out what I was here for. In fact, I think it's a great transition. I had the civil service. Whitehall is a complex organisation for very different reasons from the reasons why Oxford is a complex organisation. But dealing with complexity, understanding that the way in which you get things done, the way in which you can make progress, is through influence, it's by teeing up people, it's through relationships. That's absolutely at the heart of how you do things in universities, and certainly it is in Oxford. So in that sense, it was an ideal background. It was very different. It was very different in a good way. It was I still feel that I have perspectives that come from my Whitehall days that really help cut through things in Oxford. I've learned to be hugely careful about teeing up all the different constituencies there are at the university, but that was what we had to do in Whitehall too. So I think it's different, it's complementary, and I'm very pleased to have made that switch.
One of the, I think, it is an unfair characterization of the civil service is the idea of the civil servant as, you know, essentially a subordinate, do what they're told, quietly, you know, seen and not heard kind of thing. I mean, the civil service isn't like that today, even if it ever was. But do you get people who imagine that you are, you know, you're not a kind of proactive senior manager who is actually, you know, coordinating, pulling together and defining strategy and finding a way forward, and as you say, managing those relationships? Do you find those kind of crude prejudices exist about civil service background?
I certainly did. I will tell a story which goes back a long, long way, which is when I left private practice, when I left the city as a lawyer, and I bumped in, went to the Department of Health, and I bumped into one of the barristers that I most commonly worked with when I'd been in private practice. And he said, "Oh, I wondered what had happened to you. I assumed you'd gone off for an easy life to the civil service." So that was the most obvious example of that prejudice. I must say, I gave him a mouthful of just how exciting and how amazing the projects that I was involved in. At the time, it was the beginnings of NHS trusts. I was at the Department for Health, and designing what an NHS trust should be was a magnificent project to be part of as a lawyer. So I've always found being in government work absolutely scintillating, fascinating, important, significant. I've always rather underlined, though, the word servant in civil servant. And one of the things that I thought was so powerful in being a civil servant was that you're working with politicians who have an elected mandate to change things, to do things, to make things better, to stop things being worse. As a civil servant, you follow that mandate, but you're there to make their vision, their ideas, their plans, the things that they got elected on, possible. So that at its best, that is a fabulous partnership. It isn't always at its best, and you only have to pick up the newspapers to see that. But it was a fabulous background. These days, do people ever sort of think that I'm not planning to do anything and I'm here for an easy life? I haven't noticed that.
Well, I mean, I'm sure you have. I mean, for many of us, I think the last 9 months have been, you know, distinctively different and challenging in a way that, I mean, certainly in my working experience, I've only ever worked in higher education, but I've never seen anything like it as we've experienced in the past 9 months and the pandemic. And you clearly played a, you know, leading role in Oxford's response to that. What have been the kind of cycles that you've gone through? What are the biggest things that stick out in your mind about the preparation, the planning and the execution of the COVID response at Oxford?
I think it probably has gone in phases. I rather hoped that we'd be in a sort of stable phase now, but I don't think we quite are. But at the beginning, it was all about getting people together to work at pace. People who certainly knew each other, had an interest in each other's areas, but never hadn't really had to sit down together and come up with solutions in days, not weeks. And of course, in higher education, there are some things that can take months and longer. So we had to bring together people to work together. And we have constituencies in Oxford. I'm sure all of higher education has this, but our college system is just one extra layer of complexity. We have 39 colleges, as well as our 70 departments. And that meant that we had a number of constituencies having to come together who knew a lot about each other, but had never had to work, come up with solutions for how do you move students around? Where do you put them? Where do they sleep? How do you feed them when they're ill? How do you manage quarantine? Which was the first issue, was finding a place to put people in quarantine. How do you do all of those things? How also do you work beyond the university and support the local council in housing homeless people, which was another big push at the beginning? So it was pulling people together, creating the crisis management framework. It's worked very well in Oxford. So we call what most people call silver, we call it bronze. We always felt we didn't need three layers, so we just went with silver and bronze. So I chair the operational arm, and the vice chancellor chairs our senior group. That got going quite early on, and we just forged new relationships. I think we forged new ways of working very quickly, and it felt quite natural. So that was phase one. Could we actually all pull together? And it turned out we could. Then we had the detailed planning. So we were now into the summer. Students had gone home, of course, they weren't here in the summer term. And we just were flat out bringing in so many people who, of course, were all working from home by now. We'd already learned that was working reasonably well. We all swore over the internet connections, but broadly, it worked much better than we could have hoped. People worked flat out on preparing how we were going to digital delivery of teaching. What would the face-to-face elements be? Student accommodation, self-isolation arrangements. We decided quite early on that we wanted to have our own testing system. So designing that, putting that into place. So there was a huge amount of just rolling up our sleeves and lots of people coming together and doing really hard work. So that was phase two. Phase three is where we are now. It's our Michaelmas term, autumn term. It has gone well. We have had, just as everybody has had, we have had COVID cases, but our household system has meant that they've all been kept under control. We haven't had any unpleasant spikes. And the teaching has gone well. And despite the constraints and despite the fact that people are making sacrifices, whether they are teaching staff, support staff, students, everybody has made sacrifices, but it's gone as well as we could have expected. I'd rather hoped that that next term would be easier, but we're now in the throes of how do we do mass testing to get all the students home. So it's busier than I'd hoped, but at this stage.
Really interesting breakdown into the phases, which I was intrigued about the reference to the colleges, right? Because if I just look at Oxford from outside, I'd imagine, as you say, it would be more than just another layer of complexity. It would be it would sound like just incredibly difficult to get that diverse constituency of bodies together and pulling in the same direction, but for this, it sounds like you actually managed it.
Yeah, and got all tribute to so many people. So my job as registrar is of the university, the Central University. Yeah. The colleges are all independent charities, independent institutions. So, of course, there's been a lot of coordination and a lot of engagement with them, and they make their own decisions. But we've all been pulling in the same direction, and fabulous, fabulous contributions from people on all sides.
And what about the starter session? Because your starter term is traditionally later than lots of other universities, I think. Is that right? Did you start a bit later?
We have eight-week terms, so we both start later and finish earlier. Yeah. So we've got a lot to cram into 8 weeks. In fact, our terms do spill over. We have something we call North Week, and we have Ninth Week too. So it's just because we like to we like to make it confusing for anybody from outside. But we do have a lot of teaching to cram in. This has been a heavy teaching term, so that's been a huge focus. And feedback from academics and from students seems to be reasonably good about what we've put on. We've probably traditionally done less online teaching and less lecture capture than some of the Russell Group would have done in the past. So it was harder for some people than others.
What about the did you consciously look at what was happening elsewhere in the sector and think, well, we won't make those mistakes when we start? You say you haven't really had a massive spike. You've been able to manage it well. Do you think that you've done things differently from other universities?
So most of our undergraduates live in colleges. So yeah, we have they don't live in high rise blocks. And it wasn't straightforward to create households for them. Mm-hmm. But that's what we did. And each college has a dining hall and was able to come up with its own local arrangements. This was entirely, you know, down to their own, how they wanted to do it, but as to how they could make sure that people could eat. And indeed how they could provide food to people who were isolating. So the college system, I think, here was a strength. It meant that we had manageable groups of people and that those communities all know each other. And so obviously we had freshers arriving. It's the hardest thing, I think, has been for freshers where there weren't those relationships already with them. From their tutors and staff in their colleges. So the college system has helped no end. I think the planning has helped no end. It wasn't that we looked elsewhere and felt that people were making mistakes. I think it was just that we were unrelenting over the summer in our planning and checking it and testing it and seeing how robust it was. And thank goodness it held up. We've been helped with our testing system. So we've been doing our own test and trace. So as soon as we had a positive result, we knew, and working with the colleges and the departments, we could identify who the contacts would be, and we knew who had to isolate really, really quickly.
So say a bit more about the testing then, because was it voluntary? Was it how did you run the testing around?
So NHS test, so it's a PCR swab.
Oh, right.
Only available to people with symptoms. So it was the it's the You're standard right. test. But what was different about it was that we worked in partnership with the local hospital and were able to make sure that the tests came through when there were the longer delays in getting those results back. We didn't suffer from that. And in addition, it was the fact that we were doing the tracing. So the college would know as soon as there was a positive test at the same time as the student, or almost all of our cases have been students. We've got vanishingly small numbers of staff infected and none of them infected by any student or indeed, so far as we can tell, infected as part of their university life. I think it's 95% or over our students, and almost all of those are undergraduates. As soon as we had a positive result, we knew we could work out who their contacts were, and we could get that household to self-isolate. We did it with care. Made sure that they had some entertainment and food and all of those things to try and make it bearable. And it worked. Any college that had a cluster pretty soon had it under control.
Great. And that's really, really impressive. You mentioned earlier about the relationship with the local authority. And you were talking about housing homeless people as well, which is fantastic. How has the local authority in general responded to, what is between, yourself and Oxford Brookes and FE, a kind of large influx of students into the city, which, many may feel at the best of times as a challenge, but now, may have a different perspective on students as, virus carriers potentially. Has it been a problem in the city?
Well, two things really to say about that. One is engagement with residents and people in the city, and the other thing is the relationship between the universities, as you mentioned, Oxford Brookes, and the local authorities. So I'll take the second one first. One of the really good things about this last few months is that the relationships with colleagues in the city and the county, so public health is centred in the county tier, yeah. and then sort of everything else in the city, and those relationships have just been strengthened. We did meet, we did share information, but we've really worked together properly, and we've been integrated into the crisis management of public health and of the city. So those relationships have been all important, and quite early on we realised we needed to engage with residents, with businesses, and we held a town hall event. It was virtual, of course, but both universities turned up and were questioned by members of the public. There was a good showing from the city and the county as well. And it felt like quite a breakthrough moment. We got a lot of support. We were able to, of course, there are people in the city who think students are just here to infect them. But I think we were able to, by that event, but we did a few sort of more local engagement events as well. And there were exchanges, there was correspondence with various community groups and that sort of thing. And we were able to say what it was that we were putting in place to keep people safe and to keep our students safe. We were also really supported well by the city, who were very clear that they absolutely would defend students from any suggestions that students somehow were more dangerous or more badly behaved or more anything actually than the general population. So that's been part of the partnership.
Oh, that's really encouraging to hear, because I know, you know, around the country there have been, you know, different responses by different local authorities, and you know, feeling of students being you know, a problem, which I think is deeply unfair, because I mean it's been a hell of a year for young people generally, from March onwards and the A-levels fiasco, and then not knowing whether they'd get into the university of their choice, etc. I think, you know, they've had a really hard time. And then to be kind of victimized as, you know, the people that are causing all the problems. Just really unfair, really unfair. So that is really great to hear.
Yeah, and of course, you know, some of the students have had parties and there've been gatherings in the streets after the pubs closed. There has been that sort of thing. I mean, they're no paragons of sort of impossible virtue. But you know, when our security guys go up to them, talk to them, they disperse. It's on the whole, we've had no serious problems. There've been a few things, of course, which appear on social media as they always do. But broadly, you know, our case numbers show the fact there's been no transmission to the community, no transmission to staff, and in fact, our own the numbers of the students are lower than that demographic, than that 16 to 24 year old age group across the country.
And presumably as well, the city is very keen on your vaccine developments, they're keen to support that.
Well, Oxford's just had a fabulous research contribution to COVID, and many universities across the country are doing heroic things too. But the vaccine is, of course, extremely exciting. we're all, you know, as the nation, you know, we're all sitting here with bated breath. We don't have any privileged information, and it's all as to what will happen. But, you know, we're all hoping for announcements soon.
Yeah. Going back to your early phases, you were talking about the ways in which I think particularly professional services staff had adapted to working off-site, you know, with dodgy internet connections and the rest of it. I mean, do you feel that there has been a change of approach to thinking about the way professional services colleagues do work? Or do you think, you know, at some point we'll just go back to the traditional model of, you know, everyone being present most of the time in the same spaces?
I don't know what you think. I think those days are long over now. I don't see it going back. So most of our staff, you know, we're still in the November lockdown. Most of our staff are, of course, working from home. I'm in my office. That's what you see in the background.
Me too. Yeah.
yeah. And I do think it is essential to meet colleagues some of the time face to face. I don't think I could do my job as well if I didn't do that. So I'm coming in a couple of days a week, 2 or 3 days a week, and really enjoying it. It's so nice to see people. We've got COVID secure buildings and we wear our masks and all of that. But it is so nice to be able to see people. And important, you know, the conversations you have. The thing about Teams and Zoom calls are that you always intend to have the conversation, so you plan it. There is something different and really important about those conversations you weren't planning, but you need to have anyway. So I think we'll go to a mixed model in the future. We've already kicked off. We're trying not to kick off too much work too early because people are still working so hard on the COVID response, but we've got a new ways of working for the future group starting to get together. And I think there'll be there's what the business needs, there's what work does need to be done on site, there's how do we use our space, do we need to think about our space differently. We might well need less, that would be rather good, we might save some money, but we'll need different space too. It's not going to be the cellular offices, I don't think, of yesteryear. So we're beginning to think about all of those things. We're, as far as I can tell, we've done some surveys. Staff would like to have the flexibility. There are a lot of staff who would like to be at home some of the time. In fact, I'd say the majority are coming out as, you know, they'd like a mixed model. And then there are some people, of course, who need to be in all the time, and there are some people who want to be in all the time. So we've just got to pull together all those different strands and come up with the right blend.
Yeah, but I think it's, I mean, one of the things about the pandemic, it's accelerated all of those discussions about the ways of working which it will, I think, ultimately prove to be a very fruitful way. I mean, it's terrible that it's taken this to do it, but actually it has moved an awful lot quicker than certainly I anticipated those kind of discussions taking, which, you know, will ultimately, I think, prove to be really good for everyone's, you know, mental and physical well-being, to be honest. And we'll just, you know, be focused more on, you know, both people's health, but also about delivering the things that we want to deliver and what we need to do that, rather than just focusing on people being in the office all the time because that's the way they've always done it.
Yeah, absolutely.
The final thing I was going to mention, Jill, is, I mean, it's the kind of bigger picture stuff. You know, lots of universities have faced some financial challenges over the past 9 months, are anticipating further financial challenges into the future, particularly around student recruitment. I mean, Oxford is in a slightly different position. I'm not saying you're significantly better off on a day-to-day basis than everyone, but you've got, you know, certain advantages that other universities haven't had. But then you absolutely have to look after your money as wisely as other institutions have. But I mean, do you see significant financial challenges ahead for Oxford? And, you know, whether or not that is the case, what do you think the future holds for the sector? Because there are a lot of universities who will be significantly financially worse off than you are. Do you think there will be a shakeout? Do you think you'll see mergers elsewhere in the sector or closures of universities?
Goodness, I think the first thing is, of course, we've all got increased numbers this year. So our worst fears about the hit we would take from COVID to student numbers, international students and UK students, proved to be wrong. What we were predicting for ourselves, the sort of shortfall, and we were predicting a shortfall for ourselves in the summer, proved not to be right. And that wasn't just about the way in which A-levels worked out. It was also internationally too that numbers stayed solid. So that was a relief, and I suspect that numbers will hold up next year too. I think when there are these big events in the world, there is a flight to higher education, and you know that I suspect we'll see us will probably be true for the next 2 or 3, perhaps 4 or 5 years. Longer term, of course, the sector's under pressure. The big ticket items haven't gone away. Pensions remains a huge issue for all of us, and you know, it's looking eye-watering. Some of the figures that are being mentioned, And that doesn't look sustainable.
Yeah. Well, let's hope we're able to, to face into them in stronger ways than we have been in the past from what we've learned from the pandemic. But it's certainly going to be a challenging future. Jill, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Thanks ever so much for taking the time to chat. And we'll do it again soon, I'm sure.
Thank you.
That's all then from University Registrars talking about stuff this time. There'll be plenty more along in due course. And if you can't wait, then please do check out the Registrarism blog on wonky.com, where you'll find lots of higher education comment and fun and games. Until next time.